Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody thinks we're on the mother. Who are they to
Jaja, mother, mother, and they call me sweet where I am all of a mother.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Legacy Standing on Our Roots. This is the premier broadcast. I'm your host, Dijon Bain. Our first guest is Ed Henderson, who's the grandson of Dr. E.B. Henderson, Edwin Bancroft Henderson, who is credited with introducing basketball to the black population of the Eastern Seaboard in the Northeast. It's also the third anniversary of Dr. E.B. Henderson, long overdue induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame. I'd like to welcome Ed Henderson as a guest as we explore the legacy of his ancestor, his accomplishments, family lore, some little-known facts about his grandfather, and we explain how he created the scenario that we know today in which blacks are basketball is largely associated with blacks, not only as a professional game, but the college game, the scholastic game, and his role in laying the foundation for that in everything from the officiating of the game, the rules, scheduling, instruction, and documenting sports history in general. He was one of the first to document black sports history. Welcome, Ed.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is the third anniversary of your grandfather's induction into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. There's so much to cover in terms of your grandfather as an educator, as an author, as an activist in Falls Church, the role of his wife, Mary. And I'd like to just start, since it's the third anniversary of the induction, with you sharing a little bit about your family's effort to make sure that he was recognized by the hall, and how challenging a journey that was in him finally garnering that recognition and being honored with induction 3 years ago.
Sure. It was a long 9-year effort. I'm not going to say struggle, but an effort, you know, to get him what I believed was his rightful place in the Basketball Hall of Fame. When I discussed it with my wife, we got down to business right away, contacting everyone that was associated with him, fraternities and sororities, famous athletes, colleges and universities, athletic associations, and dignitaries, such historians such as John Hope Franklin, Henry Louis Gates, all of which wrote letters of recommendation. Also, we went to visit with the first African American to actually play in the NBA, Earl Lloyd, who at the time was the grandmaster of the parade, the George Washington parade, which they have in Alexandria every year. And we put together a coalition and documented every place that would have had an association with him. Mm-hmm. One funny story was when we approached the CIAA, who, you know, Central Interscholastic Athletic Association, originally known as the Colored Interscholastic Athletic Association. The person who was the president of that association adamantly said he didn't know who E.B. Henderson was, and this was a common problem. Come to find out, as we went through some of my grandfather's plaques, that he was inducted into the CIAA Hall of Fame.
Oh, boy.
So the first year, we created a document of 138 pages with letters, newspaper articles, and other things that documented how, or why, rather, E.B. Henderson should be inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. In 1906, when E.B. Henderson first went to Harvard, there weren't many people, black people, that were playing the game. And he nurtured the sport at its infancy and popularized it among African-American population. He started the first African-American Athletic League, the first organization for training and organizing officials to make competitions official. In 1910, started the first school league in the colored schools of Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
For these reasons, and don't forget, helping to start along with people like Conrad Norman and George Lattimore of the New York teams to create a tournament so that African Americans would have a championship, something to play for, something, a goal to aspire to in the game of basketball. And so this 138-page document that we created, we made 28 sets because there were 28 judges.
Wow.
And basically we got no response back, but we didn't give up. The next year we decided, well, maybe, you know, the judges didn't look at what we presented. But maybe if we did a video and put it on a DVD, maybe they'd spend 7 minutes watching it. So that's what we did. So the next year we created a video using a producer from Howard University's WHUT television station.
Is that Beverly Lindsay Johnson?
That would be Beverly, yes. And we still didn't get a response, but we still didn't give up. And then
a year after that, we
posted it on YouTube, and I'd almost forgotten about our nomination being there. And then all of a sudden, we got a call.
Let me backtrack a little bit. When you would follow up each year after the submitting the 138-page chronicling and the second year with the DVD, would they acknowledge having reviewed it? Or
I don't think so. I don't think they would have. I know one person in particular, the gentleman who's the broadcaster for TNT.
David
Aldridge, right. We did a interview with him not too long ago, and he said he saw this and he knew who E.B. Henderson was, and, you know, he was going to dive into it, but he didn't. And and so he was very happy when it actually did happen a few years ago. And David's a very gracious fellow. I really appreciate his support in helping our effort to promote E.B. Henderson for the Hall of Fame.
Right. He's a kind person, very considerate, and he's a awesome. What do you think, or do your family members and the people in the inner circle think turned the tide eventually? Was it one thing or was it a number of things in his favor in terms
I think there were a number of things. I think that we kept the conversation open by continuing to write and to correspond with the people at the Hall of Fame. I think that there was an effort a few years after we nominated my grandfather that they started the African American Pioneers direct election of inductees into the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that made it possible to recognize contributors who had been
when they added that category
and had been overlooked for so many years. Because when I look at it, many of the things that E.B. Henderson did,
mm-hmm.
there were many gentlemen from the northeastern New England states who worked with white leagues that did
mm-hmm.
absolutely no more than E.B. Henderson did,
mm-hmm.
but were among the first inductees into the Hall of Fame in the first
mm-hmm.
10, 20 years. And so at the year that E.B. Henderson would have been 130, he was finally recognized for his contribution to the game of basketball.
It's amazing, and it's intriguing to wonder why his name disappeared from common memory or even from sports history.
Well, if I might address that very point, in studying history myself, and I've taught it, and I've preserved it, and I write it. The public memory is approximately about 30 years. After about 30 years, if there's nothing really tangible or physical to really keep someone in the public memory,
mm-hmm.
then a lot of times that person is lost to the general public, particularly in our present-day society where we have a 72-hour news cycle.
Mm-hmm. What part of Washington did E.B. Henderson live in as a small child, and what was the composition or demographic of the neighborhood?
Okay. E.B. Henderson...
Or did he live in Washington first?
Yeah, he was born on School Street in Southwest Washington, D.C. And it was a very mixed neighborhood. Al Jolson was one of his playmates, as well as Mae West. And it was a very mixed neighborhood. And I don't know the socioeconomic status of the neighborhood, but I don't think it was a very rich part of town. I know Al Jolson's father was a cantor or something at the synagogue there in Southwest.
Oh, he's in Southwest. Okay. He's in Southwest.
Yeah.
When he was a teenager, were there yet the traditional colored high schools or any of the traditional colored vocational schools by that time? Like the M Streets and things of that nature, or did that come later?
Well, M Street was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, M Street is actually it's still there. It's called something else now, but it's still right there at the corner of M and New York Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
It's very busy there because the tunnel from under the Capitol comes out from there right now too.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't as many schools. There probably were some traditional schools that are still there.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot has changed over the years, and between integration and gentrification, I think a lot of stuff has been changed or disappeared even.
How did he matriculate toward Harvard in particular? Did he reach out to them, or was there a program, or did he find out about it through someone else?
Yeah. He found out about the program in physical training under Dr. Dudley Sargent at Harvard, who had an association with the Springfield College and James Naismith.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, E.B. Henderson actually wanted to be a doctor,
mm-hmm.
and was going to school at Howard University's Knight Medical School. But
okay.
The American Bar Association, or the National Bar Association, changed their standards so that there were no more night school courses for a medical MD degree. And he was very upset about that, because he wanted to. Many of his friends were in medical school. He very well could have been, you know, a medical doctor in his own right,
mm-hmm.
And therefore could afford my grandmother the kind of livelihood that she was used to as a upper middle class African American young lady in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And so he needed a job. So he got a job as a school teacher, and it was Miss Anita Turner who was certified to teach physical education. There was only a handful, and
mm-hmm.
all of them were women at the time,
mm-hmm.
Who encouraged him to go to Harvard and to attend the Dudley Sargent School of Physical Training. And so while there, he learned the game of basketball,
mm-hmm.
and brought it back to the district.
We're talking with Ed Henderson about his grandfather, Edwin Bancroft Henderson, the grandfather of black basketball, early basketball, introduced basketball to the Eastern Seaboard, created the first program for the high schools, the first leagues, accredited the first officials, and wrote the first history of the Negro in sport. And it's the third anniversary of his long-awaited induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Your grandfather was associated with one of the early black, if not the first significant black YMCA in D.C. Was his first involvement with that Y as an athlete, or was it as a player coach?
He was actually involved in helping to fundraise for the YMCA as well. And as you may well know, when E.B. Henderson started the team, which the 12th Street YMCA team, which claimed the Colored Basketball World Championship, in 1909-1910, it wasn't completed yet. There was no building there.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the ground was broken, I think, in 1908,
mm-hmm.
and it really didn't open until 1912, I believe. So they actually played their games just up the street at 12th and you at the
True Reformers Hall. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And True Reformers Hall, audience listeners, is was a venue in Washington, D.C., probably an upstairs venue where the likes of Duke Ellington and Jimmy Lunsford would have played.
So
his first, he plays for the Y. He's he's coach of that team that won the national championship, correct?
Yeah. Yes, he was the captain and the coach.
Okay. And did Charles Drew play on that team, or did Charles Drew play earlier?
No, Charles Drew was much younger. Charles Drew was on a team that my grandfather coached at Dunbar High School that claimed the 1922 citywide championship in basketball.
Okay.
So that was a little bit later,
mm-hmm.
about a decade or more later.
Sure. And could you enlighten our audience as to the influence that Dr. E.B. Henderson had on a young Dr. Drew, and even in terms of specifics, a way that Dr. Drew later expressed that in a letter?
Sure. E.B. Henderson coached Charles Drew in basketball, but I'm sure they also crossed paths when as E.B. Henderson was refereeing the games, football games and other sports that Charles Drew and was involved with at Dunbar High School. The officiating was done by, the contract for officiating was done by the Eastern Board of Officials, which E.B. helped to establish in 1905 or 6, so that African Americans would have a referees and scorekeepers and timekeepers and all the other things that sporting events need in order to establish official records in official sports. Upon the publishing of the first edition of The Negro in Sports in 1939, Charles Drew wrote a fascinating letter where he laid out how influential E.B. Henderson was in his own development and choice of a career. The letter is written on Columbia University Medical School records, stationery. And it's really a fascinating letter that really points out that where Dr. Drew says the character building, the emphasis on hard work and sacrifice, and the example that E.B. Henderson laid as a coach and a person laid the groundwork for his development in becoming a man and becoming a successful doctor. Now, surely E.B. Henderson can't claim all of that, because Dr. Drew was brilliant in his own right.
Sure.
But surely we all have people that we look up to and we emulate as we become adults and give back to society.
That's really, really interesting. I actually will be interviewing Dr. Drew's daughter in the subsequent airing of this show. I think most listeners would be surprised to know that after your grandfather participated in the training program at Harvard, and when he was instilling these organized athletics into the colored schools, the prevailing stereotype of the African American in the U.S. in terms of physical capability, in terms of things that required stamina, vigor, precision, thinking on one's feet, being able to be coached, being able to be trained athletically. The prevailing stereotype at the time was that blacks were really not all that well suited to be athletes. And if memory serves, there was even a prominent quote by one of the early founders, administrators of the Y, to that effect, about sports being basically the province of the Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, well, there's a quote from E.B. Henderson that basically says that given the same quality in facilities and training, the black athlete, or the Negro athlete, as he would say, is the equal or superior to the white athletes that are competing in the colleges and professional levels of that day. And he believed that. He advocated for, E.B. Henderson advocated for interracial competitions.
Mm-hmm.
He started a boycott of the U-Line Arena in
mm-hmm.
Washington, D.C. over that very issue. I think it had to do with the AAU Golden Gloves boxing
right.
competition, which takes place each year.
Mm-hmm.
And at the U-Line Arena, blacks would not be able to compete against white boxers.
Mm-hmm.
And so E.B. Henderson, who was an avid writer of letters to the editor, and had a relationship because of that with the owner of the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the sponsors for the Golden Gloves competition. What's the name? Grandma.
The Graham family already owned it then?
The Graham family, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they pulled their sponsorship, and the AAU actually changed the venue from the U-Line Arena to the National Armory, the D.C. Armory, which is probably as big as the U-Line Arena
sure.
was as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a prolific letter writer. Had probably as many letters to the Post published as anyone.
Yeah. It's been estimated that E.B. Henderson wrote over 3,000 letters to the editor of newspapers, not just the Washington Post, but before the Washington Post, the Evening Star,
mm-hmm.
and the Afro, and other newspapers as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really speaks to his championing advocacy. It was Luther Gulick, was the sports official, who said that what was really only really genetically suited to those of Anglo-Saxon stock because they were of sturdier stock and things of that nature. And the stereotype of the day, because blacks in 1910 were only, in most cases, because the 1900 census, 90% of blacks still lived in the American South and were the descendants of slaves only 35 years from the Emancipation Proclamation at that point. 1910 finds them in the beginning of the Great Migration, but it also finds them in most cities, despite having left the South, seeking more favorable conditions and better livelihoods and better education. It finds them living in the poorest parts of most of those cities, like Baltimore, Washington, and even into the Midwest, Detroit, Indianapolis, Chicago, Cincinnati, and Gary, so that their living conditions, their diet, their nutrition, their walks to school, their lack of access to exercise equipment or swimming equipment or swimming facilities was such that they were disproportionately subject to vitamin D deficiency, disproportionately subject to rickets, disproportionately subject to a lot of conditions that contributed to this stereotype that they were poorly suited to sport, and that stereotype endured until the time of Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, yeah.
And also the cerebral side of sport was one of the reasons why this this bias and this notion that they were yellow, they weren't easy to coach, they were they couldn't think on their feet, they couldn't calculate, they couldn't gauge distances. So for the sports that required quick thinking, such as a basketball, that they were actually the worst candidate. So it's significant that he did what he did after he left Harvard for many, many reasons. But that is one in terms of the physical, but also in terms of the academic. Could you share with the audience, and I'm talking to Ed Henderson, the grandson of Edwin B. Henderson, Edwin Bancroft Henderson, who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame 3 years ago. Could you share with the audience how he viewed sports, scholastic sports, as an avenue to gain young black students' entrance into the schools that had integrated in the Northeast?
Yeah. Well, you know, on the here in Washington, D.C., at the M Street High School, you had some of the most educated faculty in the nation that were very avid at placing young African American students in Ivy League colleges. One principal that comes to mind is Anna J. Cooper,
mm-hmm.
who was quite a pioneer, quite a pioneering woman, who was the principal at M Street. But what E.B. advocated was that African Americans can ill afford to be single-minded regarding sports, and that sports was an avenue into these institutions of higher learning in the North or Northeast or wherever they were. And to get a college education and to pursue a career path that was beneficial to the African American, the segregated African American community. You know, at this time, African Americans were segregated within their own communities, and the common phrase that people used was "be a credit to your race."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what he advocated for, that African Americans go to college or start a business or somehow be a credit to their race and an asset to their community. It didn't start and end with playing sports, as many people today and many youngsters today put all of their eggs in that one basket. And it's a long shot at best, and it's usually a short career, only lasting a few years. So what I tell kids when I was teaching, I'm a retired school teacher, was that you probably had a better shot at being a doctor or a lawyer than being a professional athlete. But don't give up on your dreams.
In terms of activism and advocacy and civil rights, were your grandfather and grandmother in the Henderson branch of your family the first ones to found a chapter of the NACP in Falls Church, Virginia?
The Falls Church and Vicinity NAACP that was established here beginning in 1915 was the first rural branch of that organization in the entire country. In 1915, the town of Falls Church proposed an ordinance that would have made my grandmother and grandfather have to sell their house to a white family and to move to a restricted African-American section of town. And they said, no, no way. But you have to understand that my grandmother attended the 15th Street Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C., where Francis Grimke was the pastor. And Francis Grimke's brother, Archibald, was a charter member of the NAACP and was the and established the Washington, D.C. chapter of the NAACP in 1912. So they were actually members of the NAACP in Washington. So when this atrocity took place here in Falls Church, they gathered together. They called a meeting of citizens of Falls Church, where they established a group called the Colored Citizens Protective League.
Okay.
And their first order of business was to write letters to all of the councilmen in the town of Falls Church, all of the businesses, and all of the pastors. Additionally, they wrote a letter to W.E.B. Du Bois in New York City, which was where the headquarters was at that time, not Baltimore. A letter came back saying that there were no rural branches of the organization. And that was true because in order to establish a branch, you needed 50 people to sign up. And in a small rural community like Falls Church back in those days, it would be hard to find 50 people, black people, that were willing to put their lives and their livelihoods on the line to stand up to City Hall. But they did. And the NAACP provided the organization here with legal help, and they also introduced EB to, this is in the letter, a gentleman in Richmond who was facing a similar problem regarding the situation they were facing here in Falls Church. But this was in 1915. They held a referendum vote, and the town of Falls Church actually passed a referendum to enforce the segregation ordinance. E.B. Henderson countered with a suit in Fairfax County Circuit Court, which provided an injunction so that the ordinance could not be be enforced.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the NAACP had a similar case that they had filed and was coming before the Supreme Court in 1917, Warley versus Buchanan. And I believe it was the president of the NAACP at that time, Moorfield Story, a white lawyer from Boston, who argued the case before the Supreme Court, and it was found that creating segregated districts within a municipality was unconstitutional. So the town was forced enforce the ordinance which they had passed.
But
it lingered on the books here in Falls Church until 1998, when I started the Tenor Hill Heritage Foundation, and they actually removed it from the books in 1998, and I really didn't know that it was still there, but we've built up such goodwill here in the community that they did it of their own volition.
So despite the fact that it was there were no longer widespread efforts to enforce it after a certain decade. The ordinance was never removed until the 1990s.
That's right.
Yeah, that's interesting how those things. I heard something similar about some type of segregation ordinance in Alabama that lasted until something like 2014 on the book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your grandmother was an education pioneer. Could you give a thumbnail sketch of what her role was in terms of schooling?
Yeah. Here in Falls Church, let me back up a bit. When my grandparents married in 1910, back then the basic rule was that a woman who was married can no longer teach and be a good wife and mother. So the rule in Washington was that she was no longer going to be able to teach in Washington, D.C. So when they moved out here in 1910, she concentrated on, you know, raising a family. But she also made a rule for my grandfather that if she was going to have to give up teaching, he was going to have to give up basketball. So after the 1910 championship, E.B. could no longer play basketball, but he still coached and advocated for sports and stuff like that. But my grandmother, she was approached by the community to reopen a school that had been closed during the First World War, so that the community would have a place for the children to go and to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And so she opened that school, and here in Falls Church, the Falls Church Colored School. But each year, she would get more and more students until the two-room schoolhouse, with no running water and outdoor outhouses and potbelly stoves in the middle of the room, each room, they were busting at the seams. So she would go to the school board here in Fairfax County and ask for building a new school. They would do fundraisers and bake sales, and then they would give the money to the school system and ask them to build a new school. But after 23 years of begging for a new school, she decided to take a different tact. So she took the 1938 Fairfax County Public School budget,
mm-hmm.
and she, along with an interracial group of teachers and PTA members, analyzed that budget, and their findings were that out of every dollar that Fairfax County spent on education, mm-hmm. only 2.7 cents out of each dollar went to educating African Americans, whereas 97.3
mm-hmm.
was spent to educate whites. Now, there may not have been as many blacks as there were whites, but anybody can tell you that it's hardly separate but equal. And so she created a report that was published in several newspapers called Our Shame and Disgrace. And she was promised that they would build her a new school. This is 1938. The 39 came around, 40 came around, World War II came around. And in 1945, she had decided she was going to retire, as an article in the newspaper I have. But she changed her mind when they said they were going to build a new school. So the Falls Church Colored School became the, they built a new school, and it became mm-hmm. the James Lee Elementary School on Annandale Road in Falls Church. It was the first modern school with central heat, indoor plumbing, a classroom for each grade, and an auditorium. And she was close to retirement. I think she was spent the principal there for 1 year, and then she retired.
Wow.
But in 2002, the town of Falls Church asked me to be a part of a group that was going to give a name to the new middle school that they were planning to build here in the city. And so they made the big mistake of putting me on that committee. And I was determined to have the school named for an African American, because I was looking around and I didn't see anything named after an African American out here. And so we were successful. My wife, Nikki, again, was at the forefront in helping to research and distribute information about Mary Ellen Henderson. And every school board meeting, they would read off how many emails or how many letters of support were sent in by people and what names they supported. And just like with the Hall of Fame, we approached everyone that had any association with my grandmother. And in 2004, the Mary Ellen Henderson Middle School, 2005, the Mary Ellen Henderson Middle School was opened in Falls Church, Virginia.
What a school and what a facility it is. This has really been enlightening for me, and I know it has for our audience, on the third anniversary of Dr. E.B. Henderson's investment in Basketball Hall of Fame. I didn't want to close without addressing your father's career, as well as giving you the opportunity to explain what the Tenor Hill Heritage Association is. So in either order, maybe we can look at your father's career in Tuskegee first.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And my father, Dr. James Henry Meriwether Henderson, was a biomedical researcher and professor at Tuskegee University. For many years, he was the director of the George Washington Carver Research Foundation. And in the 1950s, he worked with the Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine. And his specialty in his PhD and in his postgraduate work at Caltech was plant physiology. His specialty was cloning. Now, plants have been cloned for thousands of years, but he applied that knowledge to the cloning of the first set of immortal cells to be used in the growing of the vaccine, the polio vaccine. Of course, those were the cells of Miss Henrietta Lacks of Baltimore.
Of course.
Now, the new science building at Tuskegee is named in my father's honor, and it's right next to Milbank Hall, which is where George Washington Carver held his classes and his laboratories were located. The Tenor Hill Heritage Foundation was established in 1997 to preserve the civil rights and early African American history here in Falls Church in Northern Virginia. We have an annual blues festival in the second weekend in June each year. And we started last year having something called the Harlem Renaissance Fair in collaboration with Northern Virginia Community College. This year, in addition to the fair, there will also be the Mid-Atlantic Conference on the Harlem Renaissance, which we're organizing right now to take place April 28th, 29th, and 30th of 2017. So right now we're calling on papers. There's a call for papers, and our focus is how the DMV or the river, the area around Washington, D.C., in the teens, 20s, and 30s, tied into or helped to stimulate the Harlem Renaissance. Now, most people believe that the Harlem Renaissance was just the 1920s. However, in my opinion, and in many historians' opinions, it lasted from the early 1900s until the 1940s.
That's a good point.
And you can't cut it off, you know, like that in the 20s, you know, from 1920 to 1930. That's just not realistic. And so I'm hoping that it'll be a great conference. The Harlem Renaissance Fair, which was an evening of jazz, poetry, and dance, will move into phase two Saturday night, April the 29th. And but we're involved with a lot of different historical projects here in Falls Church, including we have a historic site. We have the Tenor Hill Civil Rights Monument, which was actually built in 1999. And coming soon this fall will be a timeline of African American history in Falls Church along Lee Highway at a new development, the Lincoln at Tenor Hill.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was the developer was Lincoln Property Company, and they approached us about using our name and having the monument and creating a plaza around the monument in front of their building.
That is really something to look forward to. How far along is the concept for that? Is everything totally decided upon?
Oh yeah, they're putting in the actual engraved stones into the sidewalk starting this week.
Okay. And how did this design? Who collaborated on the design? For the historical element of it?
The historical element was provided by the Tenor Hill Heritage Foundation, and we worked in conjunction with the city and the developer to create the concept and the actual wording. And we had to be very careful because literally the wording is etched in stone. So you can't go back and fix it once it's done. So we had to be very careful to get our facts right and get our wording right.
Well, it's been a wonderful hour. I thank you again for your time. I've always really expanded my awareness of history in every interaction that I've had with you and with Nikki. And the preservation that you do, the care that you treat, with which you treat history, not only your personal family history, but the bigger picture beyond that has always impressed me, whether it's been with National Historic Trust, whether it's been events, whether it's been sports-related, education-related, archival, photographs, documenting and saving things, or just organizing conferences. So it's really, it's admirable. That's a lot of work. There's only two of you as far as I know. I know that sometimes other players come into the picture.
Absolutely.
But I hope the audience enjoyed and learned
about your grandfather and your father and your grandmother through this guest segment. And I'd like to thank you again for being the first guest on Legacy.
Well, I'm honored to be your first guest, and I hope this bodes well for the success of this broadcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you again. Thank you again, and happy third anniversary.
Thank you.
That's it for the
You have been
broadcast.
Tuned. You have been tuned in to Legacies, Standing on Our Roots, hosted by Bijan Bain. You can contact Bijan Bain on Twitter at Bijan Bain. Follow Tribe Family Channel at Tribe Family US. This has been brought to you by Bruce George, Genius is Common. And here's a word from our sponsor.
My name is Malik Yoba. I'm here with a friendly little reminder. It's amazing how many people I talk to on a regular basis that say all kinds of crazy negative things about themselves. They often think that it's the other person, the other guy, the other girl, man or woman, that is more capable, that has more ability, that's smarter, more talented. The thing so many people don't realize is we got a little secret. If we tell ourselves that we're great, if we focus on the things we really want that exceed our current circumstance and stay true to that no matter what, you'll understand genius is common.
Greetings, this is Bruce George, founder of the Genius is Common movement. Just wanted to say hello to everybody that has joined the movement thus far. Definitely spread the word. We're in 23 states and 3 countries as of the 30th of March, 2016. I would implore you all to go to geniusiscommon.com and go to YouTube, upload your videos on YouTube. And I'm looking forward to seeing your videos, all right? God bless.
This is Bijan Bain, and thank you for joining us for our first installment of Legacy, Standing on Our Roots. We look forward to hosting again with guests such as Charlene Drew Jarvis, the daughter of Dr. Charles Drew, and Ken Morris, a descendant of the great Frederick Douglass. Thank you again.
Call me sweet where I am, oh, my loving mother. Ooh.